In a world desperately and daily seeking after joy and fulfillment, why is it that sorrow and sadness in songs and stories sell? Welcome to Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield. In today's episode of Just Around the Corner, we'll tackle that and explore some of the unique aspects of sorrow in the marketplace. I'm your host, Dennis Mansfield. It doesn't seem to make sense. Amid all the natural disasters, cultural meltdowns, gang and police shootings, there exists a market for sadness. Now think about that. An incredibly large market for sorrow and sadness. Why is this? Well, I'm joined today by Meg Rowe, a frequent contributor to this podcast, normally commenting on entertainment trends, film noir, and interesting television shows that seem to grab the attention of people. Welcome, Meg.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Honor to have you. Meg, Sadness Sells. Sad songs by Adele make millions of dollars. The recording industry's history of singer-songwriters show an ongoing trend of sadness and sorrow, all from the 70s on, really. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel, Janis Ian, James Taylor, you could keep on going. Joni Mitchell, Eric Anderson, Nick Drake, Neil Young, Randy Newman, on and on the list goes. And then, decade after decade. What do you think is the reason that sad songs sell?
Well, you know, when I'm sad and I sit and listen to a sad song, it's comforting to know that someone else has been in this position. I think that it's just phenomenal to feel like you're with someone in this moment of sorrow.
That they understand.
Yeah.
They maybe understood before you did and recorded this and maybe sent it like a gift to you.
Artists use their talent to encourage the world. And oftentimes when people are sad, especially when artists are sad, they use their artistry to encourage others to make it through and encourage themselves to make it through.
That's a good point. In fact, I don't know if you've ever heard of Professor Thomas Urola. He's at Durham University. And he wrote a fascinating article that I recently read. It was originally published in The Conversation and later picked up by The Independent, a British magazine newspaper, in which he said the following. He said, recent research shows that open and empathetic individuals typically score highly on the musical sophistication level, like, you know, the classics of Mozart, etc., while those who systematize patterns and rules tend to prefer music such as rock and punk. But what about sad music? Surely, he went on to say, people wouldn't just like it because it's sad at its core, but rather, he wrote, they prefer it because of what they feel while they're listening to it. In other words, some sad music deepens and amplifies the feelings of sorrow and loss, emotions that are connected to personal events and memories. These experiences are far from pleasurable, and they don't offer an explanation to the odd paradox. Then he went on to say in this article, among those feelings is melancholia, you know, what you and I feel on a rainy day. Maybe it's that feeling that we experience when our favorite sports team loses. But Dr. Urola writes, the most curious type of experience is the feeling of being moved, which we think is the basis of our fascination with sad music.
Absolutely.
Being moved. When I remember you posted at a sad time in your life, a song that came on and it deeply impacted you.
Yeah, I've gone through some hard stuff lately and songs have really spoken to my soul. Just feeling like, even if there's no hope in the song, feeling like somebody else truly understands, there's a hope in that. And just knowing that, well, for me, the Bible verse in Ecclesiastes about how there's everything, there's a season to everything, which happens to be a song also.
There is. From the Birds did that.
The 1960s?
About 1966 or 67.
Yeah. So to everything, there's a season and a purpose. And, you know, right now in my life, it's a sad season and that's okay. And it's not good or bad, but it's nice to know that there's other people that have dealt with sad seasons in their life.
So when people are dealing with sad seasons, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go out and buy sad songs.
No, that's what Spotify is for.
Indeed. But, you know, a very interesting example that Dr. Urola brought up in his article was that there was a national survey done that involved 102 participants from all over the U.S. listening to a particular song. Now, the song is this. Most people wouldn't recognize what that is. They wouldn't recognize that at all. People couldn't, even in the survey, recognize the song. But it's the soundtrack opening song that went throughout the entire production of Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg's production, Band of Brothers.
Ah, such a good series. Incredible. Such a good series.
When people just heard the music, there were ranges of emotions.
Absolutely.
When they then connected the dots that it was as a part of Band of Brothers, their emotions were amplified because they saw the characters, they responded to, and as Dr. Urola said, we have all experienced the feeling of relief and serenity after a good cry.
Absolutely.
I cried in that Band of Brothers as if the very men that were in it who died were my friends.
You know, I had that same experience in high school. Braveheart came out and I got the soundtrack on CD and I listened to it while I did school. I was homeschooled and I had only watched the movie once, but then when I watched the movie again, because I knew all the songs and I knew when the sadness was coming, I remember feeling this great well of emotion just from the music that I had been so familiar with.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's the same thing.
You know, when I think about the crying, another quote that stuck out as I was reading in preparation for this episode was that someone called tears, a cocktail of chemicals triggered by crying. Even fictional stories, they're enough for us to fool really our body to trigger such emotions and endocrine responses that are intended for the purpose of salving the pain in our mind, of releasing hormones that could provide help to us in that experience. So the capacity for us to understand the emotions of others is really crucial to navigating the social world in which we live. Now, that particular author, Dr. Urola, writes that the music could almost be compared to a powerful drug.
I can see that for sure.
You've had experience in your family. You have a brother that's passed away.
Yes.
And you saw the experience of drugs take him over the years.
Yeah, you know, I would say that a powerful drug like that is negative, but I would think that the powerful drug that Urola is talking about, and I'm not familiar with Urola's writings, but I would imagine it would be similar to a powerful drug that just draws out that deep well of emotion.
Yes.
And while, you know, narcotics can draw out emotion, oftentimes they do the opposite. They numb.
Yeah, they do.
And I think that music and art in particular, there's something that pulls out the emotion from us. And oftentimes, if we're in a really rough spot and we can't cry or acknowledge the emotions on our own, when we listen to a sad song or when we watch a sad movie or look at a really beautiful painting, the emotions come to life and we're able to get that out. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what he means, that it has a triggering effect to us.
And in that, you're absolutely right. And in that triggering effect is the reality that we enter into a journey, into tragedy and into sorrow, that may be actually just what our social mind craves and really needs in order to keep in shape. So the odd paradox is that in our sadness, sad songs mitigate that sadness to bring us into an understanding of joy.
Yeah, to feel lighter, for sure. Just as a really deep guttural cry, or even not a deep guttural, I've just done a lot of that lately, but any sort of cry, you feel a lot lighter after.
You really do.
You just do.
Turning from music, let's turn now to books. In particular, let's talk about grief books. Does sad sell in books? Raina Wallens wrote back in 2011, just a few months into the year. She wrote a book, and in the process of it, she realized that it didn't sell. And she continued. So she began as a researcher to ask the question, why do sad books not sell? In particular, why do grief books not sell? See, up till about 2005, when Joan Didion did The Year of Magical Thinking, which was a grief book, there were hardly any truly insightful books on the subject of grief. Something Didion discovered when she turned to reading for solace in the wake of her own husband's death. Raina Wallens goes on to say, as I did. She's a lady that lost her husband in 9/11. So from 2005 to 9/11, very few grief books were out. And she said, the only book I could find, with the exception of a couple marginally useful self-help titles, was one by C.S. Lewis, called A Grief Observed. Now, it's an honest book about him observing his wife, Joy, pass away. Yeah, it's an incredible book. In fact, ironically enough, to support Ms. Wallen's point of view in her article, Does Sad Sell, is the fact that Lewis actually released it under a pen name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know he did that.
Yeah. And when he did, it was an absolute abysmal failure. People didn't like the way this writer wrote. They didn't like how this writer expressed himself. They thought it was maudlin that he would talk about the death of his wife. People in reading just really felt, no, we'll pass. And it's a very interesting point for me. Because as I look at it, I think to myself, well, wait a minute. I wrote a book on grief.
Yeah.
And I wrote with a major publisher, Simon & Schuster. And in writing that book, I thought people would be helped by it.
I think the people that read it really were helped by it.
It's called Beautiful Nate. And it's about the loss of my 27-year-old son. And
it's,
I suppose,
beautifully written.
Thank you.
It is a wonderful, wonderful book.
I think what I learned from that experience was that though it sold thousands of copies, it didn't sell hundreds of thousands. It didn't sell 50,000. And I was really taken back. And I'd ask people, and not, you know, did you read my book? But have you read any books on grief lately? And they'd say, why would I do that?
Yeah, because it makes you think about your greatest fears. And what is the greatest fear of a parent? To lose their child. And that's what you wrote about, losing your child. So it would make sense that people wouldn't want to read that book. However, people who have lost their children, people who have dealt with, you know, loss of a spouse, who needed to understand that they're not alone in this journey, those are the people that sought it out. And mm-hmm. they were ministered to by your writing. And what was the goal of the book? Was it to make millions? I mean, yeah, we all want to make money, right? But if you helped one person,
yes,
and if you processed your own grief in that moment, mm-hmm. I think that that was really beneficial for you to have written that book.
Raina Wallens continues, and thank you for that. I appreciate that. She continues, and she asks the question, why are readers drawn to other people suffering? I wonder, why wouldn't they be? And then she says, according to the majority of book editors, they're not. They're just not drawn.
No, they're drawn to salacious issues.
Correct.
You know, like Britney Spears shaves her head and they want to know all about her. That might be an old, really old reference, but still, the salacious issues like that people are drawn to. But real, true grief, that touches our soul in a way that we weren't meant.
Yeah.
We weren't meant to grieve. You know, mm-hmm. if my belief system is that we were created to live eternal. And because of sin, when sin entered the world, that's when death entered the world. And so I don't think anyone really wants to think about death and grief and the end of things that should be ongoing. Because grief isn't just about death. There's lots of kinds of grief.
It's a good point.
Yeah, people don't want to face those fears.
That resonates with me on my worldview as well. And fundamentally, the summary of this portion of today's episode, it really is a question, an obvious question. And that is, why don't people want to empathize and find out about the sadness of other people's lives? When in fact, in music, sadness sells, that in book publishing, it doesn't.
Because of selfishness. Don't you think? When I'm listening to a song, I'm thinking about myself. I'm sad about myself. I'm not thinking about someone else necessarily.
The person who wrote it
yeah.
and who lived through
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's touching me in a way. But when you're reading about someone else's journey, there's empathy that you have to have. And if you're selfish or if you don't want to face those fears, then you're not going to tap into that empathy. I just think it comes back to selfishness.
Finally, film. Does sadness and sorrow sell in film? Well, there's a great article that was written by Katie Corner in February of 2013, a while back. But her title was The Surprising Reasons We Like Sad Movies. Her opening paragraph made me laugh. She said, isn't it a little weird that people pay money to watch other people endure tragedy after tragedy on the big screen?
Oh, like, so true.
Like watching Titanic 18 times in the first 6 months. It turns out that tragedy addicts aren't so odd after all, she writes. In fact, they might have a good reason for queuing up a cry fest. And it comes down to neurobiology. Mm. A lot goes on in our brains when we watch sad, emotional or tragic films, she writes. What's surprising is that a lot of this brain activity actually promotes feelings of happiness. And it also allows closeness in our relationships and a sense of community. And then she goes, say what?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. When we sit down to watch a movie, we, you know, have a process of being actively participating in it. Okay, our brain sees it, our sensory inputs feel it, neurocinematic research. It's a relatively new term. It finds that on a basic level, our brains are able to process a basic plot and storyline of a film in similar ways. See, we're built for story. I would argue that we're created for story.
Absolutely.
And so when the surprising response to sad movies is that people want to be engaged in those sad movies, it's really more than that. It's that they want to be engaged in life. Now, you're a Christian. You've made your observation of life in Christ a very important part of your life.
Yes.
When Jesus spoke about parables, that's not a religious term. That's a story term, isn't it?
It is.
What did he do?
Well, he used stories for people to understand his counterculture perspective of what his message he was bringing to the world.
It's as though he put film into their brains as he told a story.
Yeah, they could see it.
There was a woman. She lost a coin, and she spent the entire day trying to find that coin. And when she found it, there was great rejoicing.
Mm-hmm.
And she celebrated with her family. There was a father who gave his inheritance to his younger son. And the son went out and squandered it. And the other son stayed at home and was dutiful and obeyed. You can see this as a play, as a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the son that was reprobate lost everything and came back to the father who rejoiced with him and said, "Kill the fatted calf. My son was dead, but now he's alive." And his other son said what?
He said, "That's not fair." Yeah.
And what did the father respond to him? It was, "You've always been with me." But this guy, he was gone. We've had the joy of relationship. But this guy came back. That story that Jesus said was profound. And I think it's one of the most controversial parables in the entire New Testament.
I have to say, I do not like that parable.
I understand. And I think there are parables and stories that Jesus tells for all who read the New Testament that one of them sticks in their craw like a fishbone.
Yeah.
In their throat.
Yeah. Oh, true. That is very true. And you know, having had a brother that did rebel and I was the dutiful child at home, you know, it really does make me question what Jesus was trying to say. And yeah.
I tell you what, I hear you. There's a story of an unjust businessman.
Mm.
He's about to be fired. He knows it. So he goes to all the vendors and he says, "Hey, give me, I'll write it down 50% and you pay it off and give it to me. And you write it down 70% and blah, blah, blah." So he does this business-wide write down and he gets the money. Now, what does Jesus say in that parable, in that story? The screen writer in the sky, what does he say? That man was more shrewd than all the believers of God around him. I don't get that. Yeah. I think the guy's a schmuck. Yeah. And just like in movies, when we watch it, when we think that guy's a schmuck and he should be taken out and he lives and the hero dies.
Yeah, it's no longer about the happy ending in movies anymore. But I think that there's something so realistic about that, because the good guy doesn't always win in the end in real life. And just because you've chosen to live a good life doesn't mean that good's going to come back to you. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd hope so, but that's not always how it is. And so sometimes it's nice, it's helpful to watch someone else have the same situation.
Well, according to what we're, you know, talking about today, about song resonating with people so that they can feel happy, books not resonating with people because they don't want to feel sad, and films resonating with people because we can see the story and emotionally connect, 2 out of 3 sell, 1 doesn't. You know how many books it takes to make a New York Times bestseller?
Oh, I don't know. How many?
Over 50,000. Now you think about that. How many people would go to an opening movie?
A lot more than that.
I mean, that might be.
Yeah, I mean, like a movie theater, what has.
Movie theater may have 21 theaters and each one has 200 to 300 seats. Yeah. You're going to hit 50,000 in no time.
Yeah.
Because it's built to be productive.
Yeah. Songs well, and like we were talking about earlier when we weren't being recorded, that it's a form of art. And so it's going to touch us deeper in a different way because it's art. And the written word isn't necessarily art that touches us in the same way. Written word is wonderful and great, but it can't be interpreted in many different ways the way a movie or a piece of art or a piece of music can.
Well, Meg, you've been on our podcast many different times. We've watched films. We've reviewed films.
It's always fun to be here.
It is a joy to have you. And I'm thankful that you would take this subject of sadness and be transparent and vulnerable to the folks that listen to it. What final words would you have for people right now who are seeking solace, maybe through story or song, that you've experienced a positive thing by?
Well, I think what I've dealt with sadness is that you have to feel it. You have to delve into it and really walk through that sadness. If you don't walk through it, then it's going to come out in other areas and you're not going to be healthy in the end. And my goal in life is to be able to be joyful in all circumstances. That doesn't mean I'm happy, but I can find joy in circumstances. And even though currently my life is very sad, there's a lot of brokenness that's happening to my family, I can still find the joy, and yet I can still tap into the deep sorrow of it. And there's something so valuable about doing both. And so I would say, feel those feelings, move through it, because the other side is going to be even richer when you've healed, when I've healed. That's the hope I'm holding on to right now.
Thanks, Meg, for being our guest today. Thank you for listening to today's episode. You know, we all feel sadness and sorrow. It's part of us. It may even play a far healthier role in our lives than we ever even have given it credit for over the years. Does it sell? Sometimes in music. Sometimes in movies. Not often in books. I'm Dennis Mansfield, your host for Just Around the Corner. Thanks to Michael Seals, Ken Adams, Colin Mansfield, Meg Rowe, and Kevin Miller in the Morning for inspiring me to do and redo this podcast. Take time to enjoy your life, because as John Hay wrote, all the best gifts are just around the corner.